This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll do some math for business majors on the program today. We'll do the story behind the economics in Ukraine as well. And hey, when was the last time you heard audio that had gone viral? Maybe never, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 20th of February. Good as always to have you with us. The top of today's business and economic news comes with a theme of sorts. Math. Making the numbers add up, making one side of an equation equal the other. So, up first, a clothing company you might have heard of, The Gap, says it's going to raise its minimum wage to $10 an hour. That's a nifty raise for 65,000 or so people who work at The Gap and Banana Republic and Old Navy, to name a couple. It's also no small expense for the company. So, we gave Marketplace's Adrian Hill today's lead story to sort out for us.
What's the business case for giving a whole bunch of your employees a raise? Jack Calhoun is president of Banana Republic.
We believe it's the right thing to do. We also think that it's a great business decision that we'll get paid back for.
The thinking is that happier employees mean happier customers mean better sales. And it might be right. Retail jobs require more than telling you how cute you look in that blouse.
There are thousands of products that need to be managed. There are lots of promotions that need to be carried out, and there are lots of customers that need to be served.
Zainab Tan is author of The Good Job Strategy.
So when retailers manage this environment with employees who are not capable, committed, or motivated, then there are lots of operational problems and customer service problems.
Paying more can mean keeping more of those capable, committed, motivated people. Maureen Conway is with the Aspen Institute.
It will help them hang on to a strong workforce and build a strong workforce, and I think that that will show in terms of store sales and productivity.
It's also good for the brand. Deborah Kay is a brand strategist at Lucule.
It puts a face on the brand. It says we're interested in social issues and we're interested in our employees.
It's a message a whole lot of folks will find appealing, especially those idealistic shoppers out there. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
All right, so there you go. One version of a corporate math story. Here's another one for you, where the equation in the balance is a whole lot bigger. Facebook, as you know by now, is going to buy WhatsApp for $19 billion in stock and cash. WhatsApp has about 450 million users, so you divide by 450, carry the two, don't forget your zeros. Each user is worth about $42 a piece to Mark Zuckerberg. How did he decide they were worth that? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes it from there.
Carolyn Duke is 27, and she uses WhatsApp all the time to text her friends.
Most of my friends do have it. It's easy. It's immediate.
And it is free, unless you upgrade, even for long distance. So if Facebook is paying $19 billion for WhatsApp, which amounts to $42 per user, does that mean Facebook has to find a way to squeeze $42 out of Caroline? Because she's not going to go from paying $0 to $40, and she doesn't like ads.
So I'd probably explore other options.
I guarantee that Mark Zuckerberg did not come up with his final offer simply based on some number that he crunched to say, well, this is how much I can make per user.
David Rogers teaches digital marketing at Columbia Business School. He says, first off, WhatsApp's user base is growing fast, so Facebook could end up getting a lot more users. But part of that $42 per user is strategic value.
Half that money it paid may have been purely a defensive move, so that it doesn't get cut out of this very fast-growing space of mobile messaging.
Kathy Boyle is a senior analyst with eMarketer. She says Facebook is paying to lock in two groups it risks losing in mobile messaging.
WhatsApp has really high penetration in a lot of emerging markets, and WhatsApp is very popular with that younger demographic group.
So really, what Facebook is paying for is relevance in the future, and who knows what that's worth. Or, of course, it could be wrong and is paying way too much. That's also possible. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Speaking of paying too much, traders were in a buying mood at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. What began 3 months ago as a fight over the future of the Ukrainian economy has turned, as we all know, into something much bigger and more tragic. The BBC's Stephen Rosenberg is in Kiev. Hello, Stephen.
Hello there. Hi.
Stephen, take us away from the square and the protests and the violence of the past 24 hours and out into daily life, such as it might be. Can you go to the store and buy a loaf of bread or a jug of milk?
Some stores, yes, certainly. But other supermarkets are having problems with supplies. I heard reports today that one supermarket was packed out with shoppers, long queues, long lines of shoppers there queuing up. So there is some kind of sense of fear here that the situation is getting out of control. Reports of bank machines, ATMs being empty, or long queues at gas stations. So ordinary life is getting tougher.
Look out your window. Tell me what you see, Stephen.
Well, things are a bit quieter at the moment than they were earlier today. We're hearing sporadic gunfire and sporadic explosions, not the level of violence that we saw this morning. The situation is tense, and we are very close to the square, and a short while ago, some armed protesters came into our hotel, armed with pistols and baseball bats and crowbars. They were going floor to floor, trying to search rooms, looking for snipers, because there'd been rumours or reports that there were snipers on the roof of our hotel. So it is a tense situation. And down in the lobby of our hotel, the whole lobby has been turned into a makeshift field hospital and morgue, because throughout the day, injured protesters have been brought to this field hospital, to our hotel, for treatment. And as I say, there were a number of bodies lying on the lobby floor. We were told at least 12 bodies covered in bed sheets. So certainly today has been a very dramatic one for Kiev. This was supposed to have been a day of mourning across Ukraine for those people who'd been killed earlier in the week.
You've been in that region. You've been in Moscow and Russia and that part of the world for a long time. What's the surprising thing about this for you, if anything?
I think the biggest surprise for me is that we got to this stage. I didn't expect the political confrontation in Ukraine to spill over into violence. Ukraine has seen confrontations and conflicts before. There was the Orange Revolution a decade ago. But there wasn't violence at that time. People didn't die in that revolution. So many have died now, and that has been a shock. Not only for me, of course, but for many people in this country. People just didn't expect this explosion of violence. And it's difficult to see, at the moment, a way out of this situation.
Stephen Rosenberg with the BBC in Kiev. Stephen, thank you.
You're welcome.
According to the U.S. Census, the Indian immigrant population in Silicon Valley, defined roughly for our purposes as Santa Clara County, is just 6.6% of the total. But if you sample the high-tech industry by itself, the concentration would seem much higher. Indians have been moving to Silicon Valley for decades, but they've only become prominent fairly recently, as Marketplace's Queen Akim reports.
The data mining class at San Jose State is about to start. And that's where I met Rashia Agarwal. She's 25, from Mumbai, and a graduate student. She says for her generation of Indian engineers, Silicon Valley is like...
It's in a way like Hollywood.
Since she's been in the Valley, Agarwal has gone to a hackathon at LinkedIn, and she's met Mark Zuckerberg.
This is what we engineers dream of. I know it sounds very geeky, but that's the truth.
Here's her classmate, 25-year-old Shashank Garg.
Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Page, Sergey Brin. I literally worship them. I know at some point in time I'll be like them.
And this is Akshay Wattal. He's 24 and from Delhi.
I would aspire to be like Mark Zuckerberg. He started something from a dorm room.
Is that why you came to the Valley in the hopes of starting up a company?
Yes, definitely.
These are very audacious goals.
Venkatesh Shukla is a serial entrepreneur and investor, and he's been involved in starting up about 30 tech companies in the Valley. He says with the Valley's large Indian population and the recent appointment of Satya Nadella as Microsoft's CEO, it's hard to imagine a time when Indians didn't dream big. But Shukla says when he moved to the Valley 30 years ago, none of the Indians he knew aimed that high. And if they did?
If they did, they kept it to themselves.
I'm riding shotgun in Shukla's Mercedes and we're cruising down El Camino Real in Sunnyvale. Shukla wants to show me just how Indian the Valley has become.
Every second, third outfit, you will see an Indian grocery store or an Indian sweet store or an Indian-style beauty salon.
Shukla says when he moved to the Valley in the early 80s, none of this was here because there weren't that many Indians. But that's changed.
There's a restaurant there and a clothing shop, and there are a huge number of apartment complexes in this area. And 80 to 90% of some of these apartment complexes are young Indians.
Many of those young Indians are starting up tech companies. Today, nearly 15% of startups in Silicon Valley have at least one Indian-born founder. Shukla says in his day, that was unthinkable.
It was not part of the DNA to work for a small startup that is risky and you might lose your job and along with that your line in the green card queue. People carried the memory of scarcity and economic difficulty in India.
When Shukla tried to start his own company, he says like a lot of Indians, he hit a glass ceiling.
At that time, if you were an Indian running a company, you tended not to get funded. And the VC would hint or tell you directly that you need to get a regular CEO.
What is a regular CEO mean?
A successful white executive.
A few miles north on the Stanford University campus, I met with Vivek Wadda. He's a former tech entrepreneur and a visiting scholar at the law school.
The perception was that Indians were low-level engineers. We weren't CEO material.
By CEO material, he means someone who can wow investors, be a leader, and innovate.
So how do people who have foreign accents come to a place that's as fiercely competitive as Silicon Valley and make it big here? The answer is that they formed their own network.
In the 1990s, a small group of Indians who founded tech companies despite the odds created a group called the Indus Entrepreneurs, or TAI for short. Back in the car, Venkatesh Shukla, who's the current president of TAI, says the group has been so successful at nurturing startups that there's now an inside joke in the community here.
You know, what I hear is that the company cannot get funded unless it has one Indian co-founder.
And Shukla says Indians' penetration of the tech scene doesn't stop with the startups. Today, he says most venture capital firms have at least one Indian partner. Indians haven't just arrived. They're now a part of the landscape. In Sunnyvale, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up,
one in 300 ideas that you have gets to market and the other 299 crash and burn.
The dog-eat-dog world of the drug business. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 92 points today, almost 0.6%, closed at 16,133. The NASDAQ was up 29.7%, finished at 4,267. The S&P 500 rose 11.6%, ended things at 1839. The S&P was helped in part by Verizon Communications. Its shares rose 3.3% today after analysts talked the company up. A day after Facebook said it would buy WhatsApp, well, Facebook shares up 2.3%. Shares in BlackBerry were up 3.75% today, with some investors betting that its messaging platform might be undervalued. Investors snapped up Tesla Motors today after better-than-expected fourth-quarter results. Shares up almost 8.5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for January. Where are the nation's governors? They're headed to Washington for the National Governors Association's winter meeting. And on February 21st, 1885, the Washington Monument was dedicated in the nation's capital. There are 897 steps inside and an elevator, thank God. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a new study out from the Brookings Institution looking at inequality in 50 American cities. And there are a couple of things to point out about it. One says that big, thriving cities like New York and San Francisco have high levels of inequality. The rich there are richer than the country on average, and the poor are poorer. That much is intuitive, and we've talked about that before on the show. But point number two, cities that are more equal, well, you've still got a more or less middle-class infrastructure and maybe a better shot at a middle-class lifestyle. Those cities look an awful lot like suburbs. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
It used to be that if you were a young up-and-comer with dreams of making a life in a vibrant, thriving city, you could move to Miami, Atlanta, or New York and get by. These days, if you want a shot at a lifestyle where you're not being squeezed into a category, rich or poor, you might want to try Omaha, Wichita, or Oklahoma City.
A lot of the cities in the United States that have the lowest levels of inequality are kind of big suburbs when you look at them.
Alan Berube of the Brookings Institution is author of a new report called All Cities Are Not Created Unequal. He says cities with lower inequality are often in the South and West.
They don't actually have the sectors of the economy, like finance and technology, that tend to be driving incomes at the upper end of the distribution. They've got sectors like transportation and warehousing and retail.
Alice O'Connor, a historian at UC Santa Barbara who studies wealth and poverty, is troubled by what this means for great old cities like New York, Washington, and Boston.
This idea that a city is a place where people can go not only to reinvent themselves and have a wonderful life, but also can get ahead. I mean, that is so rapidly disappearing.
As those cities squeeze the middle class even harder, the boomburbs might start looking like pretty good places to have that wonderful life. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Big is, I think, an official business term, right? Big oil, big tobacco, and big pharma as well. There's a reason for that. In the drug industry in particular, the giants, companies like Merck and Pfizer, spend years and huge amounts of money trying to get their products to market. It's competitive, it's cutthroat, and the stakes are incredibly high, which makes the barriers to entry, the odds against a startup succeeding in the pharmaceutical business, pretty high. Back in 1994, journalist Barry Wirth found one that was making it. He followed a former Merck employee named Josh Boger as he started his own company. It's called Vertex. And then Wirth wrote about it in a book called The Billion Dollar Molecule. At the time, Vertex was burning through cash and didn't have a single product to sell. Well, now, decades and billions of dollars later, Barry Wirth has updated the story of Vertex in a book that is called The Antidote: Inside the World of New Pharma. Barry, it's good to talk to you.
Good to be here.
This is, as I said, a sequel of sorts to a book you did 20 years ago about this company. And I want to start with your perception of change in the pharmaceutical industry, because for a long time it's been big pharma, right? That's what we all call the big pharma. And now you've coined maybe a new phrase, new pharma. What does that mean? What's the change?
In 1989, when Vertex opened its doors, Merck was the greatest drug discovery company in the world. It was also the most admired corporation in America. And it was leading the majors all towards a number of breakthrough medicines, cholesterol, hypertension, asthma. It was a kind of a golden age, but that whole hegemony has been exhausted, and now the innovations are primarily coming from smaller companies like Vertex.
What was Josh Boger trying to do when he started this company?
You know, when he left Merck in 1989, he went home without having taken anybody with him, no patents, no proprietary information, no technologies, nothing. And he sat at his whiteboard for several weeks sort of figuring out what he wanted to do. And he wrote down three things. One was make better drugs faster. The second was become Merck but better. And the third was build the 21st century biopharmaceutical company. So the goal there was not just to capitalize on some new technology or some new insight into some disease area, but build the whole infrastructure for actually building out a productive, sustainable R&D pipeline.
It took a while for him to get going. This company went years and years and years without a product hitting the market.
Well, you've got to be an excellent salesman for sure. This is not like another tech industry where you can cook up a cool idea in your dorm room and within a couple of years turn it into a billion-dollar product or a $10 billion company. Pharmaceuticals are a long, hard slog. Every stage of it is extremely difficult and extremely expensive. Boger had a big enough vision and at the same time had the determination to continue to raise money for all that time. It became a little easier in 2006 when they finally realized they were going to have a blockbuster on their hand. Hmm. But even after that, it took another $1.5 billion to get to market with that drug and to keep the rest of the pipeline moving.
I confess I was surprised by the extent to which you mentioned Wall Street and stock prices and investors and the markets.
There's no place to raise that kind of money but Wall Street. You know, we would like to imagine that if somebody had a good idea, the money would come. But the fact is, biotechnology and pharmaceuticals generally are an extremely high-risk business. One in 300 ideas that you have gets to market, and the other 299 crash and burn. So there's a tremendous pressure, but the upside is if you do take your shot on goal and make it, the rewards are enormous. You know, within the first year after Vertex introduced its hepatitis C drug, it sold $1.3 billion worth of product. Mm. So if you can get there, you might be able to recoup your investment. But the chances of getting there are really very small.
How much have investors, by which I mean, you know, mom and pop who have Merck and GlaxoSmithKline in their 401ks, but also mm-hmm. big institutional investors, how much have we gotten accustomed to really big returns and great dividends from Big Pharma?
Well, you know, I think we're all complicit in this. Everybody complains about the high cost of healthcare, and everybody complains about the high cost of pharmaceuticals. First of all, drugs only comprise about 10% of the healthcare economy. So if you really want to know where the budget-busting prices are coming from, it's from really from hospital care. But looking ahead, I don't know that everybody's going to be able to have drug stocks in their 401k and then at the same time be able to complain about the fact that drug prices are so high.
It's called The Antidote: Inside the World of New Pharma. It's a follow-up of sorts to Barry Wirth's earlier book called The Billion Dollar Molecule. Barry, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai. Good speaking with you.
What's popular on the internet changes practically by the day, or really even by the minute. Squirrel! But in all that chaos, there are some things you can count on. People like to click on and share, in no particular order, cute animals, celebrity mishaps, and surprising facts. And yet when it comes to audio, and I'm not talking songs here, but sounds and stories like this very radio broadcast, well, that never really does seem to go viral, does it? Stan Elkhorn explains why not.
Until last month, Nitzan Zimmerman's title was editor of the internet at Gawker.com. Sitting on his living room couch, he would wade through hundreds of websites every day, prospecting for lowbrow gold.
Yeah, the very last post I wrote was black gay dads post adorable photo of daughters get bashed with hate.
Viral content is what it's often called, and it spreads faster and further than the flu on Facebook and other social networks. As a result, Zimmerman's audience on Gawker was more than a third the size of the entire New York Times websites.
Ultimately, the idea is that every post generates 100,000 views.
Views which bring revenue from advertisers. And I do mean views.
When it comes to audio, it requires a little bit more of a sell.
Unlike text and video, you can't skim sound. So to sell it, Zimmerman has to convince his web audience to stop browsing and listen from beginning to end.
It requires more effort, and the return on investment sometimes is lower.
But he's had at least one audio post break that pattern.
Yeah, it's public radio reporter interviews his two little girls after one gives the other the worst haircut ever.
When did you realize that something had gone wrong?
When I was finished and I put the scissors back and I looked at her and I was like, uh-oh, this is bad, 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 bad.
The interviewer was Jeff Cohen at WNPR in Hartford. He thought his 3-minute audio snapshot would get passed around by his family and his friends. But after Gawker picked it up, it took off on social media, and it got listens in the millions.
My phone started ringing with television producers who wanted to put my kids in a limo and go to New York to be on television the next morning, and it was a great response.
But he didn't embark on a new career in internet audio. In fact, those millions of listens didn't make him a cent.
Yeah, so banking on viral hits as your business model, if you're the producer, is not a very good strategy, I would say.
Jake Shapiro is the CEO of the Public Radio Exchange. He says that part of the problem is that audio is still a business built around radio waves. At a digital audio festival called Radio Vision, I put the question to Alexis Ohanian.
Thank you very much.
Founder of social news site Reddit.
What would it take to put audio like on the Reddit front page?
Oh, that's interesting.
To answer, he pointed to liberal-leaning Upworthy, which confounded his expectations last year to become one of the most shared sites on Facebook.
Perhaps someone here in the audience is going to show us all wrong, and a year from now we're going to look at the Upworthy for audio. So, go make it.
One website trying to make it is BuzzFeed. Editorial director Jack Shepard thinks an audience on mobile devices could be more open to audio than what he calls the bored at work network. Think of it as the bored in the car network.
Yeah, or like the bored in line for the movie network.
BuzzFeed is hiring someone to produce podcasts and, quote, individual pieces of highly shareable audio, such as...
I don't right now know what that's going to be. Like, my whole career, it's been something about cats. It's come back to cats, but I don't know. Cats don't make that great of sounds all the time, so we might have to find something else.
In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes to us from the pages of Time magazine, and about which, frankly, I've got a quibble or two. Time went out and interviewed, and I'm using air quotes here, candy experts to figure out which are the most influential candy bars of all times. First of all, what? Second of all, how do they rank Snickers only number 5? And finally, Kit Kat comes out on top. How does that happen? Scraping pretty low for things to name whatever it is of the year. Aren't you now, Time? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Thursday. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. And oh yeah, this is 8 p.m.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.